Hi, this is Bill Hines. I am your instructor for this course, and this tape is the counseling session, which was first recorded in 1999 at the annual conference of the International Association of Biblical Counselors. In the counseling session, I sought at that time to take students through 4 weeks worth of sessions with one person. Now, we did it very briefly and did it by way of going through the notes. You will find that in your syllabus, the 4 sessions on a person by the name of Gene, which is roughly following the same session that you would find in the book Leaving Yesterday Behind, a book I wrote in 1997. If you have read that book for the course Counseling the Victim, but you need not have that book to make sense of all this. We'll be going through that. We go through a brief PDI, personal data inventory, another thing that you will find in your syllabus. Now, there may be some reference to some charts on the heart and other things that are not included in your syllabus, and don't let that concern you. As you listen, I believe you'll be able to make some sense of it, and it just was not worth taking that out of the tape. So I hope that as you listen to this, it'll give you greater confidence for the counseling session. And if you're already a seasoned counselor, I believe you'll at least have a good introduction to the Ira Quill, which I have found very, very, very helpful. Even though Dr. Eirich shared his whole wheel concept with me after I've been counseling a number of years, I still find it very helpful. It helps me stay on track, helps me stay focused, helps me return when I realize that I'm getting off track with a counselee. Then it helps me return to focus. So as you listen to this tape, again, it was done in a live audience. There are minimal questions, but there are a few times that you will hear a blank spot in the tape because you can't hear the question very well, but that should not distract too much from the learning process. So I hope you enjoy it, and I hope it is helpful.
So this session is the counseling session, and again, what we hope to do is just give you some tools for better going in, sitting down with your client or counselee or the person you're trying to help, and go through a session with that person. And we'll actually try to go through about 4 sessions, just something I've done in the past, and just show you how I did it in terms of gathering data and where we proceeded. The approach that I'm going to show you is a disciplined approach, but I think you'll find it as being flexible as well. I'd like to begin actually with section 2 and show you what I'm talking about. On your weekly counseling record on the back side, I believe, you see a wheel up in the top right corner. And that wheel I've called the Eirich wheel because Howard devised it. And he refers to it as a multidimensional process. The idea is that you begin here at high noon with building involvement, and by beginning to establish a relationship with the client, then you begin to build rapport. Building involvement may be as simple as seeing the guy drive up in a pickup truck and saying, "Hey, I drive a pickup truck. How do you like Chevy? I've got a Ford." Now, I don't mean that in any kind of a manipulative way, but simply connecting with them where you can connect with them. Perhaps they go to a particular church and you know the pastor or you know people there. Just beginning to build involvement, but as you go along, you'll make that involvement more and more personal as you get to know them a little bit better. And the next time you see them, "Well, how's your mom? Now, I remember you said that she was ill." But building involvement shows them that you do care, that you're not simply there just to tell them what to do, but that you really care about them. The next step is that of gathering data. Gathering data is done in a number of ways, but as you visit with the person, you simply want to find out what they're about, what's happened in the last week in regards to what you've talked about. Now, there may be a place for chit-chat. People do it differently. At the beginning of the session, I'll often say, you know, what's happening? You know, your son graduated last week. How did that go? You know, that has to do more with building involvement. When we're gathering data as it concerns the issues at hand. And each time you'll gain more data. Each time perhaps something will come to their mind that they're willing to tell you or that they didn't think to tell you before. As you get to know them, I've had people that after I've seen them many times, maybe even 6 or 8 times, then they'll drop the bombshell. Well, you know, what I didn't tell you is that, you know, this happened, or I did this, or when I was this age, this happened to me, and I've never really told anybody about that. And so, while you want to invite them to tell you all pertinent information up front, sometimes they just won't. And when you get new information, you just want to fit it in where it belongs within the overall scheme. If it's one of those sorts of things that kind of changes everything, then you need to just back up and say, well, this changes a lot. We've got to back up here and begin again in some respects. That might happen, for instance, if a marriage is having a lot of trouble and perhaps a wife knows that something's wrong, but she doesn't know what, and she thinks it's her fault, and finds out perhaps that he's been having a 3 or 4 year affair many sessions into the counseling process. And then we have to back up, because then we have a new dynamic, obviously, going on, a whole new issue of forgiveness and repentance and things like that. So gathering data may change things along the way, and you want to be certain to ask them. Often I will begin a session. As you go through your weekly list there, at the top it says to review last week's homework, and then it talks about further data gathering, and I will often ask them, have you thought of anything that you've not told me up to this point that would be helpful to our process? And often they will say, well, I did think this, I don't know if it matters, but I did think about this. And that's all very helpful. We move on then to isolating the problem. Now, if you're in one of my other seminars, I'll deal a lot with the heart. We always want to get to the issue of the heart and the motivations. And that will be at issue in every session. I'm scrambling here to look for an overhead that might be helpful that I didn't think about using until just now. Now, I'm not great at computer graphics, so I put together this, and those little blue lines, that's my attempt at a fountain or at a spring. We often deal with behavior, with feelings, with attitudes, depending on sort of what therapy approach you're using if you were coming from a secular approach. But what we want to do biblically is we want to get at the heart, because we know the heart is the wellspring of life and everything springs from the heart. And so the attitudes, the feelings, the behavior all flow from the heart. So whatever the presenting problem is, whatever they come in complaining about, we know that what they may be doing up here in terms of behavior, let's say acting out in anger and rages, it's not just a matter of subduing their rages and giving them medication, say, to calm them down. It's getting at what is the heart, what is flowing out of the heart that has the behavior develop in this way. And behind the behavior, feelings and attitudes. I'm not saying that these top three on the pyramid are not worthy of consideration. Certainly they are. And often as we begin to work on behavior with it in mind that we're going to get to the heart, to the motivations, as we work on the behavior, that often helps to lead us to the things behind the behavior. So if somebody comes in, they are cutting themselves, we want to get them to stop cutting themselves. I remember a woman once said, you know, I just sit there and I'll cut myself with a razor until I hit a major vein or an artery, and then I just try to get to the emergency room. Well, she said, and I just don't understand why I'm doing it. And I said, well, first off, I don't care why you're doing it. It has to stop now. Then we'll worry about why you're doing it. What got you there in the first place? So there is a time, certainly, to try to put a lid on, especially destructive behavior like that. But we want to get to the heart as well. What is the motivation? What's going on down there that would have them doing these things that are presenting such an issue in their lives? So back to the wheel. As we begin to isolate the problem, it is the heart issue that we want to get to. Then we need to determine our direction. How are we going to take this counselee through a process that will end or result in he or she really having the tools to take on the issues in their lives? And I say result in because our goal is not that when they leave our counseling that they will have everything resolved. That won't happen. But what we hope they will have are the tools to continue to work and resolve these issues. Someone that's dealt with anger, when they leave me, when their counseling relationship is terminated, I hope that they have left after I have seen them under control, and perhaps their husband or their wife is able to corroborate that. Yeah, he's really been tested a few times. He did pretty well. I can tell he's really working on this stuff. And that's why often if it's an issue like that, I will ask them to come back in 6 weeks and then maybe in 6 months for some checkups. But I don't expect that every anger issue is going to be resolved, but that he will have a commitment and the tools to continue to work in a good direction in terms of Christian maturity. Sometimes we get caught up in that issue of having everything resolved, and we carry on counseling much further than it needs to go. Really what they need at that point is just further discipleship, which they should be able to find in an accountability relationship with somebody in their church, another Christian brother or sister. So we want to determine the direction. How are we going to go? We need to rethink the problem. You know, I get angry at my wife, the man says. She does this. A man said to me, she came downstairs and she told me that it was time for dinner. And she came in and she said such and such. And she knows that when she does that, it just punches my buttons. And she knows I'm going to react. And so I grabbed her and I threw her out of the room. And I said, okay, so as we talked about a little bit more, I said, so why did you throw her out of the room? Because she did this. And she knows when she does that I'm going to get angry. And I said, well, when she does that, it sounds like you're out of control. Yeah, and she knows it. I mean, he kept going back. She knows it. She knows it's going to work that way. Said, well, are you out of control, like you just really can't stop yourself? Yeah, and she knows it's going to work that way. And I said, well, are you out of control in such a way that you feel like you just can't be restrained at that point? Yeah, although he was a little more hesitant as he saw me probing. He said, yeah, and of course she knows. And I said, well, are you out of control? Like, we need to lock you up because you can't control yourself and you need to be in a hospital or in a jail so that you won't hurt somebody. And he said, no, not that out of control. And I said, well, then, is it really her fault or are you simply choosing to act out this way? Well, he didn't want to be locked up. And he said, yeah, I guess I'm choosing. Well, that's rethinking the problem. She punches my buttons, I'm fully responsible. Regardless of what she does, I'm responsible for how I respond. That's beginning to rethink. Confrontation. Now, let's take the same man. As he's rethinking this, as he's understanding this, then I may confront him with the fact that he has greatly damaged his relationship with his wife. He not only owes her an apology, but he needs to formally ask her forgiveness and entreat her to help him deal with this in the future. And so that would be, in a simple form, a confrontation. Giving hope is extremely important. After you confront somebody, obviously, you know, and often they can be down. If they're not mad, they can be down because they've been faced with their sin. And we want to rush in with the hope that Christ can forgive you, can give your wife the ability to forgive you. He can change you so that you aren't acting out in these ways. You know, the gospel has its effect here. And we want to be able to give hope, whatever the problem may be. Somebody is depressed. We need to give the hope that God knows what's going on, that God's in the big middle of it, that their depression, what it means is that there's something that they are down about, and whatever the issue may be, assuming it's not organic, that the hope is that they can identify with Christ, and perhaps more importantly, he can identify with them, because he has been down himself to the point of sweating blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. We begin to give hope. It's great to have a whole kind of battery of scriptures kind of in your head or in your desk that you can just pull out and say, let me just read you a few verses here about what God promised to do. Perhaps the Jeremiah 29 passage about, I know the plans I have for you, plans to do good and not evil. Now you want to be sure that it's a good hermeneutic, that you're not just pulling out things that are out of context. You might even explain as you go to some places, now this was a promise God made to David to deliver him from his enemies, and I believe it applies to us today because it's the same faithful God that was faithful to David. What it does is that puts it in context, that you're teaching them something about interpreting Scripture yourself, and you're teaching them how to apply it. So that we hope to give hope. We want to gain their commitment. Now, Counselee, will you work with me on this? Will you go down the road with me, and will you do your homework this week? I'm going to give you some things to do in a moment. And I want to know that you're going to do this and that you're going to work hard in this process. I don't want to waste your time. I don't want you to waste my time. But there's real reason to hope. There's real reason to believe that God can work in your relationship with Him and with whomever you're struggling with. That God can work in your situation. But I want your commitment, that you're going to be committed to this for the next 6 weeks or whatever you decide is appropriate. And often they will say, yes, I'm with you. Now, very generally speaking, I found women to be more on-the-spot honest than men. Some men will say, yeah, I'm right with you. You know, you're the king of the world. You're great. You know, you know you're the greatest counselor I've ever seen. Walk out and say, I'm never going back there again. Women will tend to say, I don't know. I don't know if I'm into this. Sometimes men will too. But if they say that, if they're hesitant on their commitment, probe a little bit further. What keeps you from committing yourself to the process? Are you concerned about me, my credentials, the direction I'm going? Are you concerned that you're just not up to the task? They may come out and say, what I was looking for was somebody who would just pretty much listen. I don't want to do anything. And at that point, we can give them hope that when you're ready to do something, when you're ready to be involved in your sanctification, in this process God wants you to take you through, I hope you'll come back. And I'm going to look forward to seeing you. And you can end it with that. Because you don't want them there just kind of hanging on, just kind of wanting to listen. And, you know, I just want you to hear me. And I've had people say that. And I've just said, let me apologize. I probably didn't explain what my vision of biblical counseling is. And I would just say, you know, here's what we're trying to do as biblical counselors. It sounds like what you want is more this other type approach. And I can't or won't offer you that, because that's not what I believe is really needed. So I do wish you well. And if I can be of any help, come back. But gain their commitment. And if you have any hesitancy, or if you have any concern that they're telling you they're committed but they're not really, just ask them. Say, now, you know, I get some hesitancy in your voice. Is everything okay? You know, or are we going to meet next week? And get them to talk back to you. You may, if it's somebody that you think you should hang in there with a little bit, you may just say, well, let me give you an assignment. Let me invite you back next week. And after you think about it for the week, after you work through this assignment, let's talk a little bit more. You may offer them one more session to decide on the commitment thing. But that's just a call you have to make on the spot, you know, when you see the person, as you look into their eyes and try to ascertain where they are. Sometimes their hesitancy is simply they're nervous about this process. They didn't know it was going to require work. They're afraid of what you're about to assign them in terms of homework. It may even be that they don't read very well. Oh no, he's going to give me a book. And that's why when you get to the assigning homework stage, and you always want to assign homework, you always want to give them something to do that relates to this, to their issues, so that they are involved in the process. One of the things that we have on our original, on our sheets that we send out, have to do with that we ask them that they will be involved in a church during the time that they're coming to counseling, that they will be faithfully attending church services on Sunday. Something else that I do is always try to get them involved in devotional reading at least. And that may be very simple. It may be an assignment to read Scripture 5 minutes a day and pray 2 minutes. That's 7 minutes a day, and it leaves you a lot of other time for whatever else you have to do. So it may be very simple to start off with. Teenagers, I've got a little study sheet on Psalm 139 that any of you could fill out probably without reading Psalm 139. But it just goes day by day, Monday through Saturday. Sunday, I tell them to make notes concerning the sermon at church and to make application notes on that. So it's a six-day study. And it's simply like, does God know, you know, is God everywhere at once? Where it's talking about, you know, where can I go from your presence and things like that. Very simple things, but it helps them see, hey, I can read the Bible myself and get something out of it. Very simple. I wrote it for high school students. I use it for all ages. And like I say, a lot of people sit down there and fill it all out without reading the Bible, which isn't the point. But but you may need to start simply. Some people that you can tell are motivated, like, you know, I'll have women come in, and I just love this when they do. They'll come in and they say, well, I thought I'd give you some information. And they, you know, several pages of typed, you know, computer-generated stuff, just talking about the problem, what they've done about it, everybody that's ever been involved in their lives. And that's great, great help. Not everybody's so motivated. So you have to think through it a little bit and see what they can do. You may, when you evaluate the homework, you may decide and discover that, you know, they didn't really get it. You know, they didn't do very well. You may give them the same assignment again. You don't want to discourage them, but you say, now this time when you go back through, instead of answering yes or no, I want a little dialogue about these questions, depending on the type of assignment it was. But evaluating the homework is trying to take the homework, tie it back into the issue. Be sure that they saw how it applies to the issue that you're dealing with, back to the isolated problem. Now, let me show you one other thing, which is a real helpful aspect of this process. At any point, as you're going through this, you may jump around on this wheel. Let's say, and I know I'm in some people's way, I don't know what I did with my pen, but just drawing a line there from gathering hope, gathering data to giving hope. You may begin to gather data, and she begins to cry. And you may say, oh, what is it that you're thinking about or that you just said that is particularly painful? And she tells you, best she understands it. Well, you want to jump right to hope and say, isn't it neat that God talks about that here? And maybe share that passage. You may go from that point of gathering data, spending the next 30 minutes on hope, and jumping up to assigning homework, you know, here in this first session or first or second session. A woman came in to me once, and she said in the introductory stages, she said, well, I'm going through a messy divorce. My husband is really mean, and he's really trying to hurt me, and I've got these two boys. And almost as an aside, at the end she said, oh, and by the way, something else, a few weeks ago we were walking along the street because our car broke down and a car came by and ran over one of my twins and killed him. And saving that for last, probably because it was the most painful. And so obviously we're jumping from gathering data to hope. And we're dealing with that for a long time. By the way, that woman, against some great odds, which unfortunately came from her own church, she really dealt well with that. She's doing well today. That was several years ago. And I'm very very proud of her for the way that she has persevered and hung in there with the Lord. One of the particularly painful things about that was... little twist was that he was an identical twin, so she was looking at him every day, so to speak, in the other young man. When people come in, you want to have some information to go on, and we again use what we call the PDI or the personal data inventory. There are several of those around. We use one originally designed by Jay Adams that he offers. You can just make copies of it in the back of Christian Counselor's Manual, I believe it is. Howard Eirich has same general information. There's a CD that he sells through Trinity that is basically all of his notes on Introduction to Biblical Counseling. Has a lot of forms and charts and things like the personal data inventory that can be copied out of there. But let's look at one that I've drawn up. This is one that is described in my book. I have a book downstairs called Leaving Yesterday Behind, and I hope this session doesn't seem like a crass commercial for that book, because I'm using that book as an example of what I take people through that are dealing with certain kinds of things. But it's just easy for me to do it that way. But in that, I start with Gene's story. And by the way, Gene's story is a composite of several people. And the way I came up with the name, whenever I used a name in the book as an illustration, I either asked the next person that came in the room to give me a girl's name or a boy's name, my kids usually, or I would turn on the radio and the first name I heard, I would use that as for the illustration. With the exception of one time they mentioned Elvis, and I thought that was a little too obvious. Anyway, so Gene came up because my wife walked in the room. I said, I need an illustration, give me a girl's name. She said, Gene, use my middle name. But this isn't my wife. This is just some pertinent information that we would take off the PDI. She is 31. She's married. She has no children. She's been divorced 4 years and then remarried. Not to the same person. She's been married to Jack for 2 years. Medical history. She had a miscarriage during her first marriage. She has been diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, mainly because they just didn't know what was wrong with her. She has anxiety and panic attacks. Often, 2 times a week. The doctor wants her on medication. She's unsure as to whether she should go on medication. She came to me because she wanted a Christian counselor and was referred to us by her pastor. She's been a Christian for 3 years. She got into a Bible study with some people from work right after her divorce, and it's there that she met Jack, a very fine Christian man. One of the key elements in her whole recovery was him. He just really hung in there, came to meet with me. He was just available anytime I needed him to do whatever I told him to do. Great guy. She attends church 2 times a week, typically on Sundays and Wednesdays. Her parents are particularly important, unfortunately for negative reasons. Her dad, a wealthy salesman, alcoholic, she tells us. He's had a mistress for 20 years, but she just found out about it. The daughter just found out about it. The mom has known for most of the time, but liked to use it as leverage. So the mother would not say anything about the mistress, but she would say enough about it that he wondered if she knew, and then she had the leverage that she wanted. The mom's a socialite, also an alcoholic, very manipulative. She sees her children as an extension of herself. Probably more to point, she sees her children as her hope of doing what she is not able to do and accomplish those kinds of things. So in the first session, and if you would like a copy of the backside and have written on it, you're welcome to borrow and see if you can get copies made. I'm just saying, if you want a master, if you want to take it home with you, you're welcome to get copies of my white copy and make some if you want it, or perhaps better yet, if you want to tell me afterward, I'll just see how many we need and have them available this afternoon. Now I've redone it because I needed it bigger so I don't have the wheel on here. This is just some information that you might write down. I don't expect you to type it in your session, but so you could read it. Again, you have the weekly counseling session with Gene and the date and the session number, the counselor initials here. Now, some people don't like to use the name. They number their cases. Depends what your level of security is and all of that. You'll have to obviously have their name somewhere with their code on it. To start here with reviewing last week's homework, which in this first session is to go over the PDI. I just asked them, let me read through this and ask you some questions. Some people send it in ahead of time. You may require that. And if so, go over it first time and write your questions out on the side in red or something. And then you can go back through, ask them whatever questions you need to, having gone through their data inventory. I noted here that her PDI was very thorough, that she seems motivated because she really filled it out well. Not just like she was an obsessive kind of person, but their data inventory. I noted here that her PDI was very thorough, that she seems motivated because she really filled it out well. Not just like she was an obsessive kind of person, but she seemed to put some real thought into it. Under gathering further data, over here on the agenda in the upper right, I use that just to remind myself, where do I want to go with this session? So I filled out this before she gets there. And after this, I would fill out the agenda for the next week while this is still fresh on my mind, if I'm doing it right. The agenda for me is just introductions. Does she have any questions about me? I may ask her. We've talked. Do you have any questions about me? Credentials? Do I have kids? All that kind of stuff. And sometimes they do. Sometimes they really want to know where I'm coming from. What's my history? Sometimes they want to know how confidential is this. You have to have a clear understanding in your own mind about confidentiality. What are the limits on that? What is legally required? What is required of your church or the people for whom you are counseling or within your own counseling ministry? And you want to be real upfront with them. People that come to me know that if they tell me that they're going to go hurt somebody, if they tell me that they've beaten their children or whatever, that I'm going to have to take some action and report them to proper authorities, whether it would be church authorities or civil authorities. You want to be real upfront with that so they don't feel later like you kind of came in the back door, manipulated them. You want to gain commitment as to further sessions was my agenda for this one. PDI obviously covers a lot. I'm going to ask, that's pretty broad. I'm going to ask a lot of questions with that. And I'm going to be sure when she leaves that I understand, where are we going? Is she coming back? Is this what she wants? Now, later, I just made another note up here in this box to be explored later. Is there bitterness? Is there a fear of man? I think in this first session she mentioned some people say she's codependent, so that's kind of a red flag. Is she have an inordinate fear of man? So I set out to do this. Her homework in this regard was filling out the PDI before she came. I mailed that to her. Gathering for further data. Halo data is a term I think Jay uses in a counseling manual. Just what do they look like? You know, what's the aura, so to speak, about them? She's well dressed. She appears shy, but she appears very interested. I got her story, and again, very briefly, you saw the information there about her parents. Fourth grade, or maybe it was third grade, she said that she lost a library book. And she went to bed every night. She described it this way. I went to bed every night from October till the end of the school year, crying myself to sleep because I was afraid my mother was going to find out that I'd lost a library book. At the end of the year, she found out she had turned it in and forgotten. But that's the kind of fear that she had of her mother and what her mother might do to her. And the reason her mother would do it to her is because, after all, she's so stupid, and why would any daughter of mine mess up like this so badly? Obviously, that's a simple little thing. You can imagine how she felt about more important things. Her dad was rarely around. When he was nice enough when he wasn't drunk, but when he was drunk, he would not be so nice, did not get into physical abuse, more just neglect, more just there but not there. She determined through the years that he was drunk to avoid her mother. As she went on through her life and got married, she got married mainly to get out of the house. She got pregnant. She herself began having a drinking problem. She got pregnant, miscarried. And the mother, for some reason, didn't like the doctor's diagnosis of the miscarriage. And she continued to suspect through her adult life that her mother got the doctor to change on the papers what had happened. The family had gone to this doctor for a long time. The mother had some power over him and got him to write down a diagnosis that was more favorable to her thinking about her daughter. So that's the kind of manipulation involved in her life from her mother. She became, as I said earlier, she became a Christian after going to a Bible study, really found in Christ forgiveness and the things that the gospel certainly is all about. It was everything I could tell, a true conversion. Got into a church that was a very strong teaching church, very strong in terms of worship. Some would maybe consider it a bit rigid, but nevertheless a very good church for her, for her husband. He was a great guy. He was very motivated to help her. The problem was that she would be sitting in her office at work, and she would just begin to get sweaty palms. She would begin to sweat all over. She would become short of breath. She would feel like she just needed to run, and often she would run out, run to a bathroom, lock herself in a stall till she could get composed. Sometimes it would get so bad she would have to go home, but then was afraid to drive because of her dizziness and things like that. So a lot of anxiety and these panic attacks. The hope that I'll get to a little more of her story as we go along. The hope that we talk about was that Scripture really does have the answer, 2 Corinthians 3:16. And that we're not here to bash your parents. We're here simply to understand and deal with the whole situation biblically. Because even though she has real concern, even anger toward her parents, she didn't want to just come in with what she had seen on talk shows on television and just bash everybody. She wanted real help herself. So I gave her hope that that's indeed what we would do. The only reason that we will get into anything concerning her parents is for the purpose of understanding who and what she needs to forgive, who and what she needs to confront, if anything, and what sin patterns have been established in her life. So how has she thought about relationship with her parents through the years, perhaps, and how does that lead to her present problem? But it's not to live in the past, it's not to go back there, it's not to resolve it all. It's simply to understand it and press on so we can really truly leave it behind. So the problem list that we develop: panic attacks, fear. She was afraid of the dark. She was afraid of what people think. She was afraid of having a child. A real sense of dread. She feels guilty. Often people that have been grown up in a situation like that just feel guilty. Intense guilt. Homework that the homework I gave her was to begin a fear or anxiety journal, which was simply to write down the times that she either felt like she was afraid or experienced anxiety during the day. It would be the date, the time, any pertinent information. Sometimes pertinent information might include, what did she just eat? And, you know, depending on what the problem is. Is there any connection here with, I get headaches. Well, what did you eat, you know, right before that? Well, I had some chocolate or this or that. So we just ask them to use their imagination in filling out these journals as to what information might be pertinent. Don't worry about writing down stuff that's not pertinent. We'll decide that as we go along. And then begin her in the book Leaving Yesterday Behind with chapter 11. And I gave her a study guide that goes along with Leaving Yesterday Behind, and asked her to work on section 1. Chapter 11 is basically, what is the purpose in working at things? What is the purpose in growing as a Christian? What's to love God and to love your neighbor? The two great commandments. And that's what that deals with. This is toward helping her gain a greater commitment to the whole process. And then the study guide in section one covers, just giving me a timeline of the things that she remembers as being most important in her life, 0 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 15, 16 to 20, and then the years broaden out a little bit more, going on up just to include anybody that comes in that might be older. So that's pretty much session one. We won't spend that much time on each one, but just wanted to give you an idea of going through this. By the way, another thing that is probably helpful is we need to think through what is your understanding, what is it that you will decide concerning counseling people of the opposite sex. In this case, or in any case with any woman that I counsel, I do counsel women. If it's a marriage issue, I counsel them with their husbands. But certainly I always insist that the husband know that they are coming for counseling. The only exception to that would be if it's a situation of abuse. In that case, I insist that the pastor, her pastor, know that she's coming to me for counseling. There's always other people around. If I'm, say, doing a Saturday morning session where there's nobody else at the church, I take some of my kids, one or more of my kids, and they are in the next room doing homework or playing around or doing whatever. Always somebody around. But you need to decide ahead of time what you're going to do about that and be very careful. There's always transference. You know, whether you're a guy and you're considered a real hunk, you know, man on the beach, or whether you're not, you still want to act like every woman wants me, and you need to take precautions that way. And I really mean that. If you'll never go wrong being too careful. You don't want to be silly about it, but you'll never go wrong being too careful. And certainly if you're married, your wife needs to know what's going on. Somebody will come in and they may say, is anybody going to know I'm here? Well, I say, well, anybody that sees you walk in will know that you're here. My wife will know, has access to my appointment book. You know, if she wants to know, she'll know that I'm counseling somebody named Jean today. So if that's a problem to you, then you can't come see me. Just need to work out those things ahead of time. In the second session, again, I'll review last week's homework. She had a good journal. I'm going to talk a little faster now because we're running out of time. She had a good journal with 6 entries. She understood chapter 11 and she seems on board and committed to God's best. Now, the agenda I'm following today is to further explore bitterness. I want to understand what's in her heart, how she's processing all this, understand her purpose in life, which relates to the homework in Mark 12. And I want to also get to fear of man. If not today, I want to be sure I get back to that. And I've written it down again because that's I'm seeing that as possibly the isolated problem more and more. And the isolated problem will take on more and more definition as you go along. Further data. Mom called about Jean's birthday. She refused to attend if it wasn't at her own house, at Mom's house. In this case, Jack had set it up and set up a party. Well, Jean cried all day because her mom was upset with her about the birthday. Jean exhibited both anger and fear concerning her mom, very afraid of going against her, even though she and Jack have planned this party for months. Is this just Mom's way of staying into control? Saying, I won't come to your party unless it's on my turf. Now, what is the counselor doing or not doing biblically? Well, she's thinking of self as a child of her parents, not as a child of God. That's going to be real important up here in the fear of man. looks like this will be a rough one to break, was my note to myself there. What hope can I give her? Well, she lit up when I told her that there was a basic fear of man, lit up meaning in a good way, basic fear of man, and that she could be both kind and free of what others might think. She didn't think that she could go against her mom and be kind all at the same time. Now, her mom may not like it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying she could present herself in such a way that was still very Christian, very kind, and also being free of her mom. The problem list, again, isolated problem, fear of man exhibiting itself in panic, depression, anxiety. This is the further definition I'm coming up with. The homework, she's to continue the journal. She's worked through Leaving Yesterday Behind, chapters 4 through 7, which have to do with God's grace for our journey, with our identity, and with how to take on a problem and overcome it, the putting off, putting on principles. And then I have her in study guide sessions 2 and 3, which relate to those chapters. So again, a pretty detailed approach that I worked out from the first time I saw her, but added definition as we went along. Sometimes you'll work out an approach, then they'll drop some information on you, as I said earlier, and then you go back and revise the whole approach. But that's normal. Session 3, on her homework, she didn't do as well this week because she had some deadlines at work, but it was acceptable. She did work at it, just wasn't up to par with what she had done before. She had 3 entries in her journal. Again, she was probably so busy that she didn't have the same kind of panic attacks that she had had before, which is important to know. You know, if she gets busy, if she's thinking about something else, she doesn't have as much time to think about herself. So that's an important part of it. She did complete the reading and seemed to be connecting with it well. My agenda, total life restructuring, meaning that there's a chart that I show them about how one problem affects all areas of life, that it's not just isolated in different sections of your life, that one problem affects the whole. And to be explored later, God's providence. Open the subject today and pursue it more in tandem with Child of God discussion next week. That's an important aspect of it. In the further data that I gathered, she stood up to Mom, although Jack did the talking. That was okay. I had said that was fine, but they needed to be together on it. But it's also an opportunity for him to stand up for her and to let the mom know that if she wants change, she's going to have to go through Jack. And he's willing to do that. And he's also a very kind person. Stood up to the mom, went on with the birthday party as planned, but Mom did not come and Dad was out of town as usual. Mom insisted they come by her house on Sunday to get her present. And when they went by, the mom was drunk. Jean cried most of the day. And Monday, Mom called to see why they didn't come by. She didn't remember. And when Jean told her that they had been there for 30 minutes, the mom acted like she was just joking and went on to say that Mom will never admit that she was drunk. obviously, the mom knows, but won't admit it. What is she doing or not doing biblically? She thinks that she can't be both firm and kind, but God knows that God says it's possible. And that's very important. She's not doing too well at actually pulling it off, but she knows what God says about it. The problem list was the same as last week. The homework, chapters 8 and 9 dealing with anger and forgiveness, and the study guide on forgiveness that I have her working on now. I also didn't write it in here, but I have her keeping the journal. That journal in this case will be something that would be ongoing. I'm sorry?
The hope.
Oh. The hope was that God's providence, it was in God's providence, but she was not very comforted. She's upset. I'm glad you said this because this is important. She's upset but knows that we're going in the right direction and she will take comfort in that. It's kind of like she's making herself have hope, but she doesn't feel much hope today because I opened up this issue of God's providence. Could it be, the question might be put, could it be that within God's plan that God is not only the God of her life now that she's saved, but God has been there all along, and in fact, God even destined the things that her mother did as part of her growth process to make her into the part of the kingdom that He desired for her. That's something I'm going to talk about in my later seminar today in a little more depth. But we've got to understand God's providence. We've got to understand, we've got to be able to talk to people about why bad things happen, and we need to not be given to cliches, things that don't really help. You know, we can talk about what God gives freedom and God, some people would say He doesn't impose His will, this and that. Of course, He does impose His will. They know He imposes His will. Whenever they pray and He does something, He acts on behalf of their life and maybe against the person that they're praying about. So that doesn't wash with most people, especially if they've been badly hurt. We've got to get a grip on God's will. We've got to get in a position as a counselor where we don't have to apologize for God. And I'm afraid that that's often what we find ourselves doing, trying to dress it up. Yes.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you introduce prayer into the counseling session?
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't mention that. I do. Now, personally, I pray at the end of sessions. Some colleagues I know begin with prayer and end with prayer. There are times where in the middle of something, like especially if somebody is particularly upset, that I will begin to pray at that. I'll just say, let's take a minute and ask God's provision here.
Would you let the counseling pray?
Yes, if they'd like to. Often they're not that comfortable doing that, but certainly I would.
Was the length of your sessions an hour? Are you flexible? Or
supposed to be an hour.
Okay.
I am flexible, probably more flexible than I should be sometimes.
How many sessions do you have a day?
I've done as many as 8 or 9, but I think what's comfortable is 4 or 5, personally. If I could run through a little bit real quickly the last session here. Speaking of going over and being flexible, I'm trying to wrap it up here. Again, my agenda, God's providence for His children. Again, I need to get her to embrace the whole journey as something blessed by God so that she can see her whole life as blessed, not just blessed from the time she was saved. I wanted her to see God active the whole way through. It has great implications for people that are raped or traumatized or have a child die or those kinds of things. And I just open that up to you as something you're really going to have to think about. There are some good books out now on providence, written by some good people. I encourage you to get them and really seek God's understanding. So I want to explore that. She did very good on her homework, back on track. She's greatly encouraged by the study on forgiveness. In terms of further data, the mom called to complain again, and she applied principles in the book to her mom, and the conversation went much better from Jean's perspective. Mom showed frustration that Jean would not get upset and cave in on an issue. Jean remained calm, told mom, "I can't have this discussion right now. If this is important to you, come by the house so Jack and I can discuss it with you." Mom said Jack... Said she wanted Jack there so that she doesn't have to think for herself, and she hung up. But Jean was almost exuberant the first time she can remember standing up to her mom and remaining both calm and kind. So she's really on a high today, and she didn't even care that mom was cutting her down by saying she wouldn't think for herself. Of course, her whole agenda all of her life was mom wanted to think for her, and now mom's losing that grip. What is she doing? She's applying biblical principles to her thinking. She's beginning the cognitive restructuring, beginning to think biblically about these things. We shared that while she will have setbacks, this will serve as a reminder of what God has done, and she can do it again and again until it becomes who she is. This is one time, and I wanted to let her know, without pouring too much cold water on it all, I want to let her know, mom's going to call, you're going to cave in sometime, you're going to cry the rest of the day. That's going to happen. But just like in the Old Testament, God keeps saying, remember what I did then, remember this time, remember this time, remember what God did this time, and build on this. And she seemed to understand that. The problem list, it's the same, but now the focus is more on cognitive restructuring in the area of identity and fear of man. Fear of man has to do with identity and those kinds of things. She's continuing the journal. She's reading an article called Child of the King, and she's doing a study guide on the sovereignty of God. So, as we wrap up, one thing I didn't mention earlier is just in terms of the setting, be yourself, dress as you dress, don't try to be somebody else. I personally sit behind a desk. I know, you know, some counseling books say you want to be free and nothing but between you. A desk, especially in terms of if I'm counseling a woman, it keeps her over there, me over here. I've had women say, you know, can I give you a hug or can you give me a hug? And I'll say, well, you know, let's wait till somebody else is around to see it. You know, just be real up front. I've had men say, can I give you a hug? And so I usually say that's okay. But I do sit behind a desk. I think that whatever you do in terms of setting and placement, it's just simply important to be who you are, be what you're comfortable with, and they'll adapt. If they see you're comfortable and relaxed, they'll get comfortable as well. I didn't go too much into technique in terms of being attentive and all those things. And there are books on that. I'm sorry, we just didn't have time for everything. But let me close in prayer if I could. Father, I do thank you that you have gifted people to help other people, to what we call counseling or just helping somebody through the struggles in life. And I pray for those here that we would be more exuberant and empowered to go out and to do the work of counseling, to know that we can sit down with somebody, not in our own strength, not because we have slick pat answers, not because we're slick in the way that we think on our feet, so to speak, but because we have your word, and because your word working in our hearts makes us into the kind of people that can relate to another heart. I pray that you would bring us in the coming weeks, in the next year, bring us the people that you would have come to us, that we could be encouraged that you are at work, and that we could encourage them with the hope of your gospel and how it applies across the breadth of life. And I thank you for these things and pray them in the name of Christ. Amen.
Try to get a limit on the number of sessions you give the person to see if they're really doing something with it.